I think there's lots of conflicting literature as well on founder selling. In our case, in my case, selling consulting engagements was you're selling yourself and you're selling your know-how, and that's a whole different sales motion. Selling technology, there was a realization where you sold the first few customers, and then when you start hitting up bigger customers, you're still doing the selling, but very quickly the conversation can switch to, well, hang on, if you're the CEO and you're doing the outreach and you're in the first meeting, so how big are you guys exactly? Maybe we should talk about a pilot. Let's talk about a proof of concept. So there is this perception of, is there a hack to appear bigger than you are, right? And how can we solve for my co-founder, myself showing up for the second meeting rather than the first meeting? And I think that small change has allowed us to accelerate towards larger contracts, longer terms, move away from that, right, let's try, let's do a pilot, let's do a proof of concept.
MG, welcome to the Everyday Founder. You've had a pretty successful career of working for a number of tech businesses like SAP, Microsoft, before taking the dive into a consulting business in 2017. Fast forward to 2024, and you have a fully fledged SaaS business called Kavama. Run me through what that is.
Well, thanks for having me, James. And yeah, you mentioned SAP and Microsoft. My paths into those big tech giants was also through startups. So in some ways, I'm returning to familiar roots. Today, where we are, we help B2B software companies. Our tagline is sell outcomes, not product. In the world of tech stack proliferation and more products being launched every day, putting yourself in the shoes of the buyer and being able to understand what is this product actually going to do for me? That has become a growing problem. And especially in the world of SaaS, where it's not just about selling once, it's about selling all the time and showing value all the time. We find that a lot of companies struggle with this articulation of personalized value.
So you ran an agency, a consultancy. It's a very profitable business. I speak from experience. And now a SaaS business.
Yeah.
Why did you move away from such a model?
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of factors, but the number one being we believed that consulting would solve the initial problem, but when you really want to embed the solution with your sales force, with your customer success team, then you needed a technology platform. And you're right, the consulting business was a good one. It was a profitable one. We had sexy Silicon Valley clients paying us $500 an hour for our advice. So we realized that, hey, companies are willing to spend to solve this problem. How can we scale this business, right? So some of it was about scaling it. And we didn't jump in to building tech right away. It was, let's bootstrap, let's get a couple of customers using our product, let's see that this really works. And once we had enough signs from the market, that's when we said, right, let's go all in. And let's stop providing services, let's raise funding so that we can pay ourselves. And yeah, here we are.
Love it. So 2017, you leave a very nice, cushy job in professional services. You then move into consulting. Then a few years later, you start funding what is Kavama today through the back of that consulting and sort of take those chronological steps. 2017, were you thinking about SaaS? Were you thinking about tech? Or was this something which came as you went through those sort of companies, those clients, and then you get to 2021 and you start putting down fingers to keyboards and start designing the platform out.
Yeah, we were not thinking about tech in 2017. And the story is that my co-founder, Alex, and I, we were working at this mid-sized, progressive software company that had moved a few years ago from being traditional on-premise software to SaaS. And they went about this complex go-to-market shift in, right, hey, how do we start selling in the subscription world? And Alex and I were chartered with putting together what we called a customer value team. And we got stuck in with a lot of customers. We understood where they got value. We translated a lot of those learnings into Excel-based tools and got them in the hands of salespeople, in the hands of customer success teams. But we were still solving the problem with expensive people and Excel tools. And guess what? Salespeople didn't want to touch Excel tools with a 10-foot pole. So while I would say that there wasn't an immediate, we need to build tech, there was just a realization that, hey, if this company has this problem that is so big, then there's got to be hundreds or thousands that are struggling with the same new problem, growing problem. And then given our entry point into solving this problem, we felt like we were uniquely positioned to solve it.
I love that. So in 2017, as I said, you had a job, you were paying the bills, the mortgage or rent, whatever that may look like, you know, there was bills to pay. Why did you step away? Was it a really natural sort of step to take into your own business? Like for some people, that's a huge step. For others, it just seems natural.
Yeah, so in some ways, the step was kind of made for me. So the company that we were working for, they, you know, and this team, this customer value team, we were 8 expensive management consultants, and we had pockets of success, but it wasn't a scalable solution. So there was a redundancy package offered, which I took, and it's like, okay, let's figure out what's next. There was definitely a desire to double click and go deeper into the same problem set. And I think you're spot on, right? It was a comfortable setup. The corporate life suited me pretty well. And mortgage and childcare and living in London is not cheap.
It certainly isn't.
So there was opportunity to reset and say, right, what's next? And I started as a one-person, one-man band, helping customers with this problem. And one customer went to 2, went to 3, and the consulting business sort of grew organically. It wasn't a deliberate plan. In fact, so the company was called MG Pricing. The MG Pricing story was, you know, as it often starts, it was met a friend at a bar who said, MG, you know, I know you do pricing stuff. What kind of pricing do you help with? I said, we do pricing for SaaS companies. And he said, there's something you might be able to help us with. We've got a strategy meeting the next day. Do you want to just listen in, be a fly on the wall, and tell us if you can help? And apparently I said a couple of smart things in that meeting, and this mate of mine said to me, like, all right, do you think you could help us in a couple of weeks? And he gave me these forms to sign, NDA and such. I said, well, I don't really have a company set up, I don't have a name for the company. He said, well, you're MG and you do pricing. So I wrote down MG Pricing. And next thing you know, the company is got a few customers, and that's really how it got started.
I love it. Sometimes it's best just to name the business what it does.
Yeah, it does what it says on the tin. Exactly.
100%. So that's number one customer.
That was number one customer.
Talk me through how you acquired number two, number three. Like, that's hard.
Yeah. So with customer number one, so again, the same theme of the problem set that we had been solving. And there were a couple of LinkedIn posts that I put out, blogs, and it was through my business school network that another couple of friends started saying, hey, MG, do you think you could help us? And I kind of went by this rule of threes, like say yes to three and maybe one will convert. 3 months into the business, I said yes to three. All three came through. I was pulling 100-hour weeks, flying to New York to deliver a workshop in a snowstorm.
Oh, wow.
And that's when very quickly I realized that, hey, there's something real over here, and brought on a second resource to help me out.
Love that. So big hire, that first hire, whether it be a co-founder, first employee, huge importance. How the hell did you make that decision and did you get it right?
Yeah, so I went slow. So you're absolutely right. Key hire, her name is Lere. She was somebody who I had met at one of these customers, really switched on, hungry, young, bright. And we had great chemistry. She joined me for a few sales meetings. And all of a sudden, we went from being a one-man band to, hey, we're a boutique consultancy now. And we could charge better rates. And our risk profile was lowered. And she's with us today, 6 years later at Kuvama. And she's done lots of different, you know, I think one of, you said key hire, absolutely. At such an early stage, you want someone who can wear many different hats, right? And she embodied that fungibility and the ability to learn really quickly that has been, yeah, she's been a tremendous asset to us.
Love that. So you've made many hires over the years, and we'll kind of fast forward where MG Pricing goes into Kuvama. You've made some hiring decisions. You may have made some hiring mistakes along the way as well. Let's talk about those first, let's say, 2 to 5 hires, generalists or specialists. Which route should startups go?
Yeah, and somewhat unique in that we started with a consultancy business where you need more specialists. And those first few hires, so I guess to complete the story of moving from consultancy to a tech business, my co-founder Alex saw that, hey, this is a real need, it's a growing need. He joined us in the consultancy business as a partner, and then we jointly decided, hey, it's time for tech, it's time for platform. In the meantime, we were fairly risk averse and we were working with contractors, and we had this network of trusted resources that we would pull in for separate projects. So I was thoughtful about not dialing up the fixed outgoing every month. It was more on a project by project basis. Once we raised funding and we started bringing on full-time employees at Kuvama, that's when the first few were like, okay, we absolutely need a person who can do jobs 1 through 5, but at the same time is not going to get terrified job 6 through 10. So it's that unique blend of specialist with a degree of fearlessness to figure things out. So, hey, we didn't have anyone who did marketing. All right, let's learn how to do marketing, right? And let's figure out how we can try and get leads and promote content. And so there was, I would say, legal. I think that's one of the things that as a startup, all of a sudden you start having SaaS contracts and issuing shares. And there's the corporate side, there's the commercial side. No one in the team was a legal expert. So it's like, all right, let's get stuck in. Let's figure this out.
Sure.
So you want to have that unique combination of, yes, you bring something very real and tangible to the table, but also be able to fill in gaps that you're not going to be able to hire a specialist for yet.
Love it. Absolutely love it. You mentioned your funding round there. When's the right time to get a funding round sort of locked in? Was that something you were like, we can't make this business succeed if we don't get this over the line? Did you prove traction beforehand and then go, oh, this will just help us get to where we want to go quicker? Talk me through how that was. And I don't know, I don't think you'd raised funds before that, right? Not as a founder anyway.
Correct.
So yeah, what did that look like?
Correct. So I want to say the catalyst moving from consulting to tech was we won this grant from Innovate UK. It was £100,000 grant. And we had talked about product, but the grant forced our hand. So it went from being an itch we wanted to scratch to, if we don't build what we promised the government we're going to build, we're going to end up in jail. Right? So that was, it's like, okay, now we're really writing our lines of code and we are bringing on resources to start building product. There was still a lot of thought that went into, should we raise institutional capital? Because there's no turning back, right? You're on the VC, hey, train has left the station. And the decision really came down to, how serious are we about this? Because we could see a path to generating consulting revenue and use that to feed the building of the product. And it would have just been a lot slower. Once we saw the first handful of users, with real success stories, right? So you got those success stories in the first few months, and you're like, hang on, this is real. Let's take the plunge. And my co-founder and I, we're in our 40s. Where I want to say, not the typical young, optimistic, we're going to change the world. It was like, oh no, this needs to be a real problem. We need to know that we can solve the problem. We need to know that people are willing to spend a lot of money to solve this problem. And then let's take this path. So it wasn't a hasty decision. So we had one customer that was using it. We had another couple of customers that were talking about a pilot. And that's when we was like, right, let's start talking to some investors.
Yeah, love it. I mean, being risk adverse or risk taking, balance between responsibilities in life, it's a lot easier to do when you're 25 and have none of those things.
Yeah.
So let's dive into that, right? So you're a married man.
Yeah.
You've got a couple of kids.
That's right.
You live in London.
Yeah.
So, well, all three of those things are pretty expensive.
Well, in my case, actually, the married part of it is what has been made this really easy. So I'm lucky to have not just a supportive wife, but also a high earning wife. And that made a lot of this possible.
Well, I listened to another podcast with you on it, and you said you attributed kind of your success or the business itself to your wife. You kind of said she was the one that said, go do this.
Yeah, yeah.
That's pretty incredible. Yeah. Talk to me about that. How she basically pushed you into the founder door.
Yeah. So we have lived, my wife and I, we met at work 20 years ago, actually, now. And we have had a path that has been similar in that we have been in B2B software for a while. We went to business school together. Dinner table conversations are very much work-centric. So she's been part of this journey and was seeing firsthand the successes we were having as a consultancy, then with our first product. And then she said, MG, you got to do this. Right? Her exact words were, get some balls and do it.
I love it. So how do you manage the balance then? So your wife is a high performing lady, a woman, career professional.
Yeah.
So are you, except for the woman bit. how do you balance that with kids as well? I mean, look, the founder life isn't, isn't for everyone. And two, isn't often for someone who has lots of responsibilities with someone who can have to share the load pretty equally.
Yeah. I'm still figuring that out. It's not an easy one. We joke about what we call, and this is one sort of like life hack, if you will. We were thinking about how much time we spend preparing for a board meeting, and that cadence, that quarterly cadence of the opportunity to review, to reflect, to grow. A marriage is inarguably, the most important relationship. Why don't we embed some of those practices in our relationship, right? So every 3 months or so, we have an overnight stay in the countryside where there's R&R, there's long walks, there's good food and massages, but we also have an agenda. And we talk about the big life topics, the finances, our health, well-being, kids, childcare. And I want to say that's really helped. That's definitely not solved. It's not a silver bullet, but I feel like it's had a very positive impact on the quality of our marriage. It also helps with like, hey, let's not nag each other on a day-to-day basis with the small things. Let's think about the small things versus the big things, and let's park the big things to chat about at our, what we call, like I said, the QFR, quarterly family review.
I love it. I mean, at the end of the day, right, it's just trying to keep the alignment together towards that big goal, so then those little things don't niggle away at you too much.
Yeah. And I mean, we are 50-50 parents, two kids in school, and there's homework, and there's hobbies, and there's games, and there is a lot, and there are very hard trade-offs that we've had to make, and there will be a lot more.
Sure. Try and find some time for one yourself and two for both of you as well, right? There's so much you have to balance. So let's talk about, obviously, your family. You've settled in London.
Yeah.
You're a man who's lived in a fair few places. I definitely, off the top of my head, can't name all of them, but it's one that probably I couldn't count on one hand. So why London?
Yeah, so the story is, so I grew up in India, and a lot of my formative years were in the US, a lot of them in Silicon Valley, and my wife is American. So when we were dating and we were starting to get serious, she visited India and we spent a good few weeks there, and she was forthcoming in letting me know that, hey, MG, I love you, I'm serious about our relationship, but I want to be really clear that I don't see myself living in India for the long haul. And I said, okay, that's fine. I also don't see myself living in the US for the long haul. And we said, right, London is bang in the middle. It's going to work for everybody, or it's going to be an equal sacrifice. And we've been here 12 years and we love it. We absolutely love it. So this is home. Set down some roots. Not seeing us moving anytime soon.
I love it. I just got this mental image of yourself, your other half, kind of getting a world map or a globe and just putting a pin in the middle of the two places that you are.
It is bang in the middle.
that's insane. So let's talk about the US-UK divide. I think this is something, formerly I ran a digital product studio, so a tech sort of knowledge base was very important for me. And we had US clients, we had UK clients. I always think that the US is 2 to 4 years kind of ahead of tech trends compared to the UK. What do you think?
Yeah, I would say even more than 2 to 4 years, right? And especially for when you talk about new categories and bringing new products into market, then yeah, I want to say Silicon Valley is 5 to 10 years ahead of where we are in Europe.
What can we learn from them? From the big brother, some may say, some others might disagree, across the pond. What can we learn from the Valley and bring it to the London tech scene, which is increasing at a really good speed now?
But it is.
It's still got a fair way to go, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny you mentioned there's an institution called Boardwave.
trying to bring the valley to here, aren't
exactly.
they? In Europe, right?
That's exactly. Yep. And Boardwave has done an incredible job. There's 1,400 members in 2 years since its inception, 1,000 plus software CEOs in Europe. And one of the things that we can learn over here is the power of that tightly knit community. So Silicon Valley, it's a tiny geography,
yeah.
but the network and the power of it. So I think we've definitely, you know, that's, I think, one big area of learning. Venture capital, I think we have a long way to go. Right? Venture capital, although the big global players have made a big footprint in London, in Berlin, there still is a mentality, the how do we build unicorns where we're catching up over here. So some of it, I mean, I, having studied in the US, so I did my undergrad in the US, and I'm not sure what we can learn specifically, but I think there's a big difference between your top 1% graduate from an Ivy League in the US versus the top 1% graduate, let's say Oxbridge in the UK. And the belief in the US that, hey, I can change the world, I can do anything, I haven't seen that mindset in that equivalent 1% in the UK yet. Mm. Some of it is cultural.
Sure.
Some of it is just the incentive structure. I think in the US, the inherent risk-taking behavior, the limited liabilities that companies have, the directors have, I think there are some regulatory decisions that make it easier for minds to be wired that way than they are over here. But yeah, if we're talking about truly building unicorns, then I think what's really interesting, I find that in the UK, we have these incredible, this EIS and SEIS schemes, which encourage angel investments and getting companies off the ground. It's amazing. They don't have that in the US. I think the UK is unique in that ability to get early stage funding.
Hmm.
But then I think we miss a trick in taking it from early stage to the next stage.
Hmm, super interesting. I mean, I went to university in North America, in Canada.
Right.
And only for an exchange year. So I did do most of my studies in Manchester here. Loved both those experiences. Some of my best friends are from university.
Yeah.
But there was a big difference. And the biggest difference I saw was practicality. Like when I went to Canada, it was like, let's do a consultancy project. I studied business at university, and it was, let's do a consultancy project, which is we're going to get in 4 or 5 local enterprises. One of them was Samsung. Mm. And there was a few other more local in geography to Vancouver where I studied.
Yeah.
But it was like, we're going to get these businesses in. They're going to give you a real problem to you as a 21-year-old, and you're going to try and help them solve it.
Yeah.
Whilst I really found here, and maybe this is changing, I'm not exactly still at university or still up to speed potentially with the educational system, but here it was very book heavy. It was, here's an academic thesis, or here is a philosophy from X amount of years ago. All very good, but the practicality of kind of go do this was very much prominent. I really loved and enjoyed that. I think the second thing for me is there is an element of ego.
Mm.
So the US is a massive continent,
yeah.
country,
yeah.
all of that. And there is a mentality of having a bit of a, we are the best, we
yeah.
are the biggest. We have a bit of an ego, which kind of gives you that mentality of, right, then we're in the best place to change the world.
Mm.
What do you think about that? Like from an ego perspective, let's link it back to being a founder. Like, do you have an ego? Does MG have an ego?
MG has an ego for sure. But I think that there's something about the US, the US market, and a company starting in the US has the ability to grow a massive business by only serving the US. And maybe 5 years, 10 years down the road, they'll say, right, we open a European office in London or Berlin or wherever. But I feel like there's a huge opportunity for companies that are born in Europe, where very quickly you need to start thinking about, and this is true in the case of Kuvama, our second customer was based in Germany, and they had users in France, and they had users in Spain. I was like, hang on, we need to quickly adapt our product beyond these geographical boundaries. And the way I see it is those early decisions, those formative thoughts that go into building product, if you do it right in Europe, then you can take over the world, right? In the US, I think that while the US is a big enough market, crossing the Atlantic and getting product into Europe and to Asia, that's a much bigger step. Versus companies born in Europe, going to the US is not hard, and then going towards Asia as well. So I think there's a unique opportunity that we have for starting businesses in Europe.
The stumbling blocks may be a little bit bigger, the challenges may be a little bit larger, but if you can conquer Europe, I feel like we're playing Risk.
Yeah, a little bit, right?
And it's like, you can conquer Europe, that central piece, you can then move and expand.
Absolutely.
Although I feel in Risk, they always say, take Asia first.
Yeah.
Anyway, perception. We talk about sales quite a bit. Obviously, it's very much your arena. Founder-led sales.
Mm.
There was a time when MG was that one-man band doing all the sales. Talk about perception with founders in the sales cycle. You're a much bigger team now. Are you still involved in every sales decision and every sales cycle? And what do you think about founders maybe sometimes too heavily involving themselves in the sales?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And I think there's lots of conflicting literature as well on founder selling. In our case, in my case, selling consulting engagements was you're selling yourself and you're selling your know-how, and that's a whole different sales motion. Selling technology, there was a realization where you sold the first few customers, and then when you start hitting up bigger customers, you're still doing the selling, but very quickly the conversation can switch to, well, hang on, if you're the CEO and you're doing the outreach and you're in the first meeting, so how big are you guys exactly? Maybe we should talk about a pilot. Let's talk about a proof of concept. So there is this perception of, is there a hack to appear bigger than you are, right? And how can we solve for my co-founder, myself showing up for the second meeting rather than the first meeting? And I think that small change has allowed us to accelerate towards larger contracts, longer terms, move away from that, right, let's try, let's do a pilot, let's do a proof of concept.
Yeah, I mean, frustrating, right? For a CEO who's like, I can do this. Like, we're a small team of, let's say, sub 5 people, and I'm doing the outreach or whatever, and I get in front of someone, and then they kind of have that perception, and you're there going, damn, like, we could 100% deliver for this business, but because of that, their perception of me, right or wrongly, because I'm involved from the first step, there is that frustration. So let's talk practical steps. When you took that step and hired a salesperson, or did you outsource it? What's your practical steps to getting maybe that perception aside so that you can get to do what you do best, which is delivering or providing service and offering?
Yeah, and we were fortunate in bringing on a very strong salesperson early on in earlier on than most books would advise us to. And he's done an amazing job. His name is Toby. He's been with us now 2 years. And, while my co-founder Alex and myself were involved in pretty much every deal, I think in many cases he can do a better job than we can, right? And there is that sometimes as a founder, you can fall so in love with your product that the tactical selling into a multi-stakeholder environment, yeah, you can do it, but separating the, hey, here's the big vision and here's how we can change. Sometimes you need a skilled seller who can complement that founder credibility and know-how. I think that that's a winning formula.
And founder story.
And founder well. Story.
Founder story. I mean, some may argue it gets less important as the business goes on. Some may say it's the other way around. But at the end of the day, that's what only the founder can do that. And often the founder is one bringing that energy because, as you say, they're the one that's in love with their own product or service or offering. But if you get good sales first, then they should be able to do that as well.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, it's we talk about early hires and, okay, founders versus founding team. These early hires that we brought on, there was a very interesting hiring process that we used, which helped, you know, we facilitated that self-selection. So we brought people on who truly believed in the problem that we were solving, either because they were living that problem themselves or they had experienced how big of a gap there is in the market. And they're like, hang on. These guys are solving something. So there was that belief that we're onto something special, which is self-selection. I mean, you know, we're not paying market salaries by any stretch. So it's like, okay, what's it going to take for somebody to, again, quit their high-paying job, start at 30, 40% below market for generous equity, putting real skin in the game. So, you know, when you hire a salesperson, arguably coin-operated salespeople, to say, right, I'm going to take a big haircut of what my cash comp is going to be like because I believe in this, then it puts them in a different category. And that shows in the way that they are going to market.
Yeah. Let's talk about hiring. So you have grown gradually and also exponentially in your life so far by what you've told me and sort of through research that I've done on you. But when you, a lot of startups, they kind of go, oh, I need to hire and then immediately hire, if that makes sense. So they realize that they need someone to come in and help them grow. And then the next day they're putting up a job description on LinkedIn. Often that's kind of too slow and inefficient. Like how did you manage that gap of trying to hire this talent? Because frankly, it takes time, especially if you're asking people to take the pay cut or go below market rate and semi-sell them the dream. They're just the numbers game. They don't come through the door every day. It's a lot easier to go, oh, we're going to pay market rate. Who wants it? Then you can filter out more candidates. But how did you sort of bridge that gap?
So we spend a lot of calories in keeping people warm and bringing them along. So squeeze the network, people who we've worked with in previous chapters. So when we say move to hire number 6 and 7 and 8, still network or strongly endorsed by network. So that trust is already there. When we started bringing on hires from the LinkedIn job post, right? That's where, again, the process that we went through, it was relatively slow and deliberate by startup standards. So it's kind of interesting. We put out these job, you know, well written, very personalized posts that shared much more than you would normally see in a typical job description. So we would share what we're about, who we are, and you would still get, right, okay, 400 people have clicked apply on LinkedIn because it's just so easy to click that apply. It's like, okay, what are we going to do with 400 applications? Let's whittle this down. How do we do that? Let's quickly screen. Do they have startup experience? Do they know about B2B SaaS? Let's bring it down to 60. Okay, I'm not going to speak to 60 people. And we tried this experiment where we contacted each of these 60 interested parties on LinkedIn and we gave them a homework assignment. We said, hey, we're sharing some more. Here's exactly where we are as a company. Here's a demo of our product. And we asked them two pointed questions, the responses to which they needed to record on video and upload to this website, which was cheeky in some ways because we hadn't quite given them any of our time yet. So of those 60, we were expecting a fairly high percentage were going to say, who do you think you are, Kubama, right? I need to get something before I'm going to invest my time doing research, record my videos. But that's where the self-selection happened. The ones who really believed, and there was about 60%, who submitted their responses in this 2-minute Loom video recording that they uploaded on this portal. And what's remarkable is that you can very quickly gauge chemistry when somebody submits a 2-minute video recording of themselves. I'm like, okay, hang on. I know that these 20 I could never work with. Let's send them a polite no. Now let's start meeting and speaking to people. And that shortcutted our hiring process. And I can look back now and say that we've done well on that front. Our retention rates have been remarkably strong.
Love that. And yeah, it's a great way. Use video.
Video.
It's like in content. Video first is the way to go in 2024.
Exactly.
Let's talk quickly about Kuvama's proposition. Like, who's it perfect for? What pain are you truly solving for your main customers? Because you have a number of different packages. You have a number of different sort of pain points that you solve. Who's your perfect customer?
Yeah, so we still have one core offering, right? And the core offering today is targeted at B2B software companies with at least 50 salespeople. Now, when those companies have many different types of customers and many different products, then for them to cut through the noise and uncover specific prospects' pain and link them to what outcomes is my solution going to deliver, it's one of those things that it's a problem that's been around for a while, but the way companies have approached solving this problem is through training and through consultancy. And there's a whole bunch of methodologies out there that they've been built to solve this problem, but that doesn't stick. And 2 months after the training or 3 months after the training, salespeople have forgotten and they've gone back to their old habits. So that's where we come in. And in some ways we codify that training, we structure it, we make it really easy for the average, even lazy seller to be in front of a prospect and have a credible, confident, knowledge-based conversation where you get the prospect to open up. So if I say there's one thing, there's one pain that we're solving, it's helping a salesperson get their prospect to open up in that first discovery conversation.
I love it. So next 5 years, Kuvama, MG, the team, what does the next 5 years look like for you?
So we are solving the problem for sales today. And the next logical problem is customer success. Today in the SaaS world, the renewal, the expansion, revenue is moving in that direction, right? Everybody talks about land and expand. So the next thing on our roadmap is building a product for customer success. After that, and this is the big, what we call customer value management vision, and that's where our name comes from. So Kuvama stands for customer value management, is to connect all the dots in that customer lifecycle. So from sales to customer success, now you've learned so much about your customer. You understood the pains that they've had. You understood how you've solved the pains, the ones you actually solved, the ones that you didn't. But now you've got this rich data that can all feed back into product and product marketing and allow you to build product based on where value is delivered. AI has accelerated a lot of our platform development. And given our roots in consultancy, it's like, okay, hey, there's a whole lot of workshops and data collection and aggregation that goes behind that. You know, if you lift up the hood of Kuvama and look at what's underneath, it's this gnarly many-to-many mapping, lots of data, lots of challenges. But that's why AI is starting to accelerate how fast we can go to market, how fast we can sell, how fast we can deliver on time to value for our customers, and make it a lot cheaper. So we have a few other competitors in the US. Those competitors, they target the giants. You're talking minimum six-figure deals. And through AI, we're able to offer a lighter, faster, leaner offering. So that's again, becoming really exciting because we see a path to bringing something that was meant for the big enterprise, but bringing it to the masses.
Amazing. Awesome. So MG, where can people find you?
So LinkedIn, I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. I've got a little blog sort of post, what do we call them? Like a personal website called mgmusings.com. There's a few anecdotes and essays that I post on there. And mg@kuvama.com.
Love it. MG, you have been my everyday founder. Thank you so much.
Thank you, James. Cheers.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Everyday Founder. If you haven't already, like or subscribe wherever you are watching or listening to this episode. If you know of an incredible founder whose story needs to be shared, then let me know who you would like to see next on The Everyday Founder via the comment section or messaging me on LinkedIn. These episodes are brought to you by Shake Content, your LinkedIn content agency. So please show them support on all socials so that we can keep bringing you amazing guests and sharing their stories on The Everyday Founder.